Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by SuperValu Insurance, looking out for you and yours with our new life and mortgage protection insurance.
Well, multi-award-winning Dublin author Christine Dwyer Hickey has a new novel out and it's garnering great reviews. It's called Our London Lives and it follows boxer Pip and bar worker Millie from 1979 to 2017 as their lives intertwine and diverge over the years. Christine Dwyer Hickey, it's lovely to have you back in studio with me.
Thanks, Miriam. It's nice to be here.
I think it was lockdown the last time we saw you.
I think it was lockdown, yeah, it was.
Look, it's a fantastic book. Give listeners, first of all, a glimpse into the lives of Millie and Pip. They're Irish in London, but they're not typically Irish.
No, I wanted to kind of look at the outsider in London. And I wanted them not to belong to the Irish community, but they never fit really into the London set either. And he's actually half Irish and she's Irish. So I just kind of wanted to look inside them and go with them and follow their journey, as they say, over a long period of time and get to really, really know them.
And you had the character of a boxer in your head, I think, before Pip was ever fully formed. Why a boxer?
I don't know. Probably because I'm sort of intrigued. I would never enjoy looking at a boxing match. There is something awful about two people facing each other, and the object of the exercise is to punch the head off each other. And at the same time, there is something very graceful about it and courageous about it. And I just get these little notions that wander around in my head for a few years and then they start to take flesh. I had considered writing a play at one point, and I had Owen Rowe, and he's a wonderful actor. I had him and Kathy Belton, and they would be the two, I thought. She's that lovely delicacy, and he's got this power in him. Yeah. And then all sorts of things happened. I got sick and I thought a play would be it's very stressful writing a play. I tried it once and it is a very stressful exercise. And lockdown came and I wrote The Narrow Land and forgot all about it. And then it came back to me sitting in the Abbey Theatre. It came back to me again. I was listening to Fiona Shaw. There's a T.S. Eliot lecture every year and she was reciting The Wasteland and doing a wonderful job of it. I'd always wanted to write a novel set in London, but I was daunted because it's such a vast city. And I know very little about it, really. I've only worked there for a few weeks or a couple of months one summer when I was young and visits here and there. But anyway, as I sat there, I thought, you know what? T.S. Eliot was an outsider in London. And look at this wonderful long poem that captures so much of London and the loneliness of that city. And that's the way to do it as an outsider. And then the boxer started to shift around a bit. And just while I was listening to her and Millie, but they were different. They weren't Owen Rowe and Kathy Belton anymore. And it became a novel.
And you worked for a short while, didn't you, in the pub where you have Millie working?
Yeah. The outside of the pub is the same. It's completely changed inside. And it was a great experience at the time. And I spoofed my way into the job too. I'd spent enough time in pubs, Miriam, to know that there was, a certain way to pull a pint. And from the time I was a child, I was always behind the bar, running around behind the bars. And the thing is that I sort of thought, went in, and they don't do any of that, of course. You can just walk in and get the job there. Whereas here it was like a vocation. People had to do their time and they had to get their papers and they had to do all this. So anyway, I chanced my arm and I got the job. Really, I was looking for the accommodation to go with it. And so my room was like the room that Millie has. And my view out the windows, the little garret windows at the top, was the same. And the place at the time was very lively. It was very, very lively. It was real East End. But at the same time, there was a kind of an artistic touch to it too, and an intellectual touch, because all the newspapers were in the area. They're all since gone now, you know.
And you know, yourself and Dennis, you spent time in London, didn't you, to reacquaint yourselves with the places you were writing about?
Yeah, I have to get the location. If I don't get the location right, there's no point. I'm only guessing. And that's why we know I'll never write a novel set on the moon. I have to be able to be there. You know, I have to be there. But anyway, all I had was the notion of London, the idea of what the workers would do, what Minnie would do, what their job would be. Greatly exaggerated what I had in my head to my husband to get him to go with me, and found a flat. And we had a great time. We had a ball for 4 months. We did 3 months in Bayswater and a month in Notting Hill. And I didn't work when I was there. I was just to soak up London life, to get the rhythm of the city, to get to understand how it worked, what it would be like to live there rather than to be a tourist.
And one thing I always notice in your characters, Christine, is all their flaws and all their insecurities, we all have them, but you get right into their heads and we know what makes them nervous. So are they their thoughts or your thoughts?
They're theirs, I think. And it's my guessing of their thoughts, I think. Like when I was young and kind of thinking about being a writer, I remember accidentally, it's a big long story, I won't go into it, but accidentally reading Ulysses because I thought I was reading Strumpet City. And I was kind of, I liked it in the beginning even. I didn't get it, but I liked it. And then when I got to Leopold Bloom, the chapter with him, I got him straight away. And then a few pages later, I realised I'm in this fella's head. I'm actually inside his head and I'm seeing the streets through his mind. And I'm actually, he's talking to people and they don't know what he's thinking, but I know what he's thinking, but I'm only in his head. And that's the only way that this story is being told through his point of view. And I said to myself, if I ever be a writer, that's what the way I'm going to do it. So that's how I do it. I get inside their head, stay there, imagine I become them. It's a bit like method acting. And become them and just only see, hear and feel what they would see, hear and feel.
It really works. So, and of course, a big part of Pip's character is his alcoholism, his addiction.
Yeah,
that's a topic, Christine, of course, you've dealt with before. Many of my listeners will have read your book, Tatty, which gives the child's viewpoint. But this time you're telling it from the drinker's perspective.
Yeah, I kind of feel I wanted to understand the disease of alcoholism more, what it was like to be an alcoholic. And I have Pip and he's going through the recovery and he's really trying to make an effort to do it this time. And he goes to his AA meetings and he kind of hates them and he hates listening to people's stories and he's resisting everything. But it's a very hard life for him and a very lonely life because the pub has propped him up. And he kind of thinks about, well, what do you do with yourself all day? He's 60 years of age because it's divided into two sections. The first section is the past in 1979 and the alternate chapters. And he's, when we meet him, he's 60 and he's just out of rehab again, but he's been in a long time this time. And so gradually they cross, as you said in your introduction, and they come together at the end. But he is very lonely. It's too late for him to really get a career. It's too late for him to do anything. He's relying on his brother who's pretty well off and has got a life of his own, a successful life as a conductor and a musician and trumpet player. And it's just how lonely and difficult that life is. And I just wanted to understand how it felt like, because up to that, I was always looking at it from the perspective of the people who were affected by alcoholics.
Which, of course, you were.
Yes, I was. Yeah.
Your parents?
Well, my parents, and I, you know, I don't, I still feel very guilty if I discuss it, but I do realise that in this country, alcoholism is a big problem and we don't face it. And there's a huge amount of people who are what is known as adult children of alcoholics. And they carry that burden from the time they were children into their relationships when they're older. And, like my parents started life to interesting, fun people who, you know, my mother was very beautiful and she was a great singer and she had a lot going for her. And, you know, like a lot of women at the time, had to give up her job, a job she loved. And my father was very charismatic and go-getter. And, you know, they both come from, they both Dublin people. And they just got kind of caught up in, they were friendly with the bohemian crowd. Like Dublin was a drinker city at the time. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very friendly with a lot of poets and writers and artists and people who wouldn't, we didn't live that life ourselves. You know, we'd our dinner at the same time every day and we went to bed at different times and that. But there was an element of chaos within the family and it increased as we grew up. You know.
And you remember being, for instance, in the pub, the Bailey, a lot, didn't you? Even when you were a little child.
No, I remember being a small child and being collected from somewhere late and being brought into the Bailey and told, sit in the corner there now and keep quiet. And looking up and seeing all the clouds of smoke and all the glasses and listening to all the people. And of course, the people who drank in the Bailey were very glamorous. You know, there was quite a glamorous thing about it. And when I saw the very first episode of Mad Men, when he's sitting in a bar, in a cocktail bar, I said, oh my God, that reminded me of it. Or in that film, Days of Wine and Roses with Jack Lemmon. And Lee Remick, when it opens, you see that you can see how easy it is to get caught up in it. You know, the buzz and the glamour. And they just, and it just became a problem with them, and it just ultimately destroyed their marriage.
And your mum, she did leave you.
Oh. She left the family home. She left the family home, which was very unusual at the time. Mm. And it's very, in a way, it was a relief because the marriage was so difficult, and you know, it was so much hardship within it, and for us watching it, it was terrible. And the whole family, like, what people forget is that it's not just the alcoholics, it's the alcoholic family, that everybody in that family is affected and tries to find different ways to survive it. But that's all in the past now. Both my parents are dead, and I just kind of feel sorry for them when I look back. Mm. They had a lot to deal with. It was a difficult time to be a woman. It was a difficult time in Ireland in some ways, you know, but they had, you know, five children altogether in the end. And I'm the only girl, and I have four brothers, and my eldest brother has special needs, and that was very difficult too. And they did look after him very well, and they took care of him in a way that other parents wouldn't have done. They would have put him into care or something. Mm. And he lives an independent life. St. Michael's House look after him, but he's his own flat. And he's his own. He was there at my book launch the other day. Nobody messes with him. Nobody, like, you know, the packed house, absolutely packed house. And the only one who kept kind of heckling in the end was Tony. And, you know, nobody messes with him, and he has his life and he enjoys his life.
And when you look back on the young Christine, and I think it's lovely, and even a lot of people in I interview often say when they look back on their parents now from a distance, having thought maybe not so kindly of them, they review the situation. But you were still in school, for instance, when your mum left. So what long-term impact do you think it did have on you as a young woman?
Well, I, you know, when I was starting fifth year, I got very sick and I got this viral pneumonia and I missed most of fifth year. And then I was in sixth year. And their marriage was really bad. Or their marriage was really sort of, you know, was very, very difficult. And then my mother left, and there was a lot of coming and going, and she'd leave and come back and that. And I suppose it probably changed. I didn't go to college. I ended up just sort of going away then and didn't go to college. And then I don't know. But in the end, it worked out fine, because I think if I had had a very stable relationship and I had gone to, you know, I always wanted to go to Trinity. If I had gone to Trinity and studied English, which I would have wanted to do, I'd probably be an academic and I wouldn't have written.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So these things. My childhood was difficult for a lot of people. For a writer, it was ideal. I was always meeting, you know, funny people, different people. As I said, always with my father. Always going in and out of pubs with him. He had great time for me. He talked to me all the time. He always insisted on you thinking about things, looking at people. And you'd meet, and he was friends with everybody. And he was a racing man. So you'd meet at the race course, you meet everybody from aristocrats to the fellas who are bookies runners. And, you know, and so I was always with him and in the car with, you know, all sorts of peculiar people and everything. And that, I think, fed into my understanding of human nature.
Yeah, and one of his best friends was the beautiful poet Patrick Kavanagh.
Patrick Kavanagh is a very good friend. They fell out for a while because actually Kavanagh advised him to put my brother away. He said it's bad for the other children. And they fell out for a little while and then they became friends again. But there was a big age difference. Like, Kavanagh was quite a few years old, was old enough to be his father, really. And there's a big age difference. But they were great friends. And my father wanted to be a poet. And he showed Kavanagh his work. And Kavanagh said, only do what you're excellent at. You're not bad, but you're not excellent. And he never did it again. Or he wrote a few little verse-y things for us when we were kids and that, but he didn't do it. Which I actually think changed my father's life. A bit of encouragement. You know, people have to develop as writers. You can't just come out and presume that, you know, you're going to be just fully formed, fully fledged at your first attempts. And I think it affected him. He was a frustrated writer.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. And my mother, who was a wonderful jazz singer, she was offered a chance to go on the stage in the Royal Theatre, one of those Queen's Royals or something. Mm. And her mother said, no daughter of mine is standing on a stage. That she thought it was like, you know, it was a common thing to do and you're not going to do it. And that probably changed her as well.
Yeah.
Because years later, I remember she went on the stage sang with Lou Kelly on the stage. And she loved it when she was there. And I never saw her as happy. I remember that when I was a child. They did it. There was some show and I can't remember what I was in the Olympia.
People probably had frustrating lives.
Yeah,
and
you
were
have
frustrated.
To do. Yeah, you have to do
unhappy.
What you need to do.
So when did you meet your Prince Charming, Dennis,
my
your
Prince
husband?
Charming, a long, long time. Do you know, we celebrated our 43rd anniversary yesterday.
Happy anniversary.
And do you know how we celebrated?
No.
We got the chipper. We got food from the chipper. We were so exhausted after the book launch. We were supposed to go out and go out for dinner and everything. And I just looked at him and I said, I want to go. I just want to stay in and have chips, fish and chips. Will we do that? He said, OK, thank God you said it. We were just so jaded. It's been full on with this book for the last couple of weeks.
So where did you meet him?
I met him in Dublin. Actually, met him in Kentucky, the first time in the Kentucky Fried Chicken. On the way somewhere from one pub to the other, to a nightclub or something, my pal. And he went in, he said to his pal the next day, I met these two young ones last night. You want to hear the language out of them, he said. But anyway, and then I met him again. I bumped into him again and, you know, we had a bit of a thing. And then it stopped. And then I met him the second time and we just kicked off. We've been together an awful long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You seem really happy, actually.
We are very happy, yeah. We are, yeah.
And he had a health scare.
Oh, you stopped, Mary. It was dreadful. Last January, to heart attack. Yeah. Out of the blue. He's always been the robust one in the family. He looks after us all. He is very good. I mean, I hate this. Thank God he's not listening. He's out in the car. He won't listen to me because he doesn't want to know what I'm going to say. Praising your own husband. I'll probably give out to him for the rest of the day. But anyway, it's a very un-Dublin thing to do. But we went away and we went to Seville. We'd been in Italy before and he got sick. He got some kind of COVID infection thing, a virus. And then immediately after, he got a vomiting bug. And then we came home and he wasn't as himself over Christmas. And we decided we'd go to Seville for a week's holiday. And we were there like 2 minutes and he got sick again. And then I got sick and the two of us were really sick. And he was kind of more, he looked as if he was coming around and he was more concerned about me because I have an autoimmune condition and he was kind of worried about, would we go home? Would we stay? Was it safe to go on the plane? But anyway, we got home somehow and we were home about 2 days and he had his dinner and he stood up and he said, I don't feel right. And I knew by his colour and his head just dropped. And for a minute, I thought he was having a stroke or something. Mm. And we rang an ambulance and thank God, my son and his girlfriend and their little baby were living with us at the time. And we rang an ambulance and they said they sent the ambulance and no sign of the ambulance coming. And two things Dennis always gives out about. He gives out about ads. He hates ads. And we have to turn off the ads if we're watching anything on the telly. Gives out stink, especially around Christmas. And Brown Thomas's car park. The cheek of them with the little ramps, he's saying. Paying them. Well, what is that? I don't have to pretend I parked on the street when I go into town because he'd be giving out. But anyway, while I was sitting there looking at him getting worse and no sign of the ambulance, this vision bloomed into my head of a big clock in Brown Thomas's car park, an ad, a big clock that said, with no finger numbers on it that said, your heart doesn't know what time it is. The Matter private cardiac unit. And I rang them. I could barely hold the phone. My hand was shaking so much. And I had a quick chat with them. And she said, will I send an ambulance? And I said, I think we'd be quicker in a taxi. So my son went with them in the taxi. I couldn't go. And they came in, they took a blood test. They knew immediately he'd had a heart attack. So they took him in. And he was in there and into the intensive care. And then he was in the Matter for 2 weeks. I couldn't see him for a week. I nearly lost my life. I just didn't know what was going to happen.
Was that because you were sick and you couldn't?
I was sick. Yeah. I wasn't allowed to go and see him. Yeah. And I was sick. And then the second week I went in to see him. But I just could not bear the idea of not him not being existing anymore, you know, not being with me anymore. It just suddenly hit me. I never thought of it before. I actually never thought of it before. I always thought I'd be the first to go, so I don't have to think about that.
Why?
Because I have an autoimmune condition and something, I've been told way before COVID, something like the flu or food poisoning will wipe you out. You have to be very careful. Mm. And you have 10 years less life expectancy than other people. So, you know, I just presumed it would be me. But then suddenly to have that happen to Dennis. But thankfully, he's back to normal. He's himself again now. He's great. So it wasn't his heart. There's nothing wrong with his heart. The muscle that pumps the heart became inflamed because of the viral infections. Wow. And you know, when we were going to Seville and flying back from Italy, packed planes, people sneeze and coughing. We were the only two wearing a mask. Because of me, we were wearing a mask. The only two. And if people forget how rampant the whether it's COVID or whatever, it's mutated into the same COVID that we knew, how much of it is out there.
And because you were so worried that you would lose him, so did you become a different person? Were you beautiful to him from the moment he came home?
Oh, I was. I was fawning all over him.
How long did that last?
Well, I do spoil him a bit now, you know. My kids say it to me, I do spoil him a bit, but it comes and goes, you'd say.
And of course, you had the Dublin launch. You mentioned that earlier. Yeah. Your brother was at. You're going to London for another launch there.
Yeah.
You're expecting a mixed gathering, Dukes and Boxers in England? Yeah, yeah.
My Boxers. I love my Boxers. I got to know the Boxers when I was in London. And there's a man called Mickey Delaney, who's second generation Irish. And he's 80 years of age and he's taken more kids off the street. And he's a wonderful fella, wonderful man. And he hasn't been well, but he's better now and he's coming. And there's going to be 10 Boxers coming to it. They confirmed the other day. And then I'm hopeful he's going to do his best to come. The Duke of Buccleuch, I can't pronounce his name properly, but he presented me with the Walter Scott Prize when I won. During COVID, I won it. I couldn't go there because it was all cancelled. There's a big festival in Scotland and he invites the shortlist of people to come and to stay the weekend in his castle and you're made a great fuss of. But when it was over, he brought me over. Oh, he's a really, really nice man. Brought me over and you think I was after winning that year's prize. I was on the stage more than anybody else. I was actually embarrassed for the winner. I was sort of saying, sorry, you go up, you go up. They made such a fuss of me. But anyway, we kind of clicked and he's going to do his best. So I'm hopeful that he'll be there as well.
That's just one other award. I was researching, obviously, you for this interview. You've won so many awards. Does that make you feel very confident as a writer? Do you feel correctly valued as a writer in your own country? Well, how do you feel?
I don't know. I don't think about it too much. I mean, I am asked a lot, do I feel undervalued? You ask me now, you put another spin on, do you feel valued? I just write. I mean, the writer me and the person that goes out, it's, they're two different people. When I'm writing, I'm fully immersed myself in my work. And I mean, I know I'm a good writer. I don't think, I mean, not everybody will like my work. And I don't think anybody should expect to write a book that everybody's going to like. It would be very, you know, it would be very odd to do that, I think. But I when I write, I know something happens. And I mean, when I was younger, I probably felt that I wasn't getting recognised. But it's a very difficult job. And there are more and more writers coming on board all the time and less outlets. So I just want to be a good writer and I want to write well and do the best book I can do. And if that happens and occasionally I get a bit of recognition through an award or a prize or something, fine. But I don't really want to be a celebrity or anything like that. You know what I mean? Mm. I just want to, I have enough of whatever it is. I have enough of it. I'm happy the way things are at the moment.
It's a beautiful book, this book. It's like, it's also made for the screen in a way. Do you ever think like that when you're writing books?
Well, I mean, the Narrowland, the film rights have been sold and renewed a few times. And the same with the Cold Eye of Heaven, but it never happened. No, I don't when I'm writing it, I don't think. But I am a very visual writer. I look at what I'm writing in my head. And I don't think that way.
And you've a growing brood of grandchildren, to dote on. How many do you have?
I have 4. Suddenly it happened. Like when the last book was out, I had none. And then suddenly now I have 3 little scallywags and a little brand new baby boy. And the 3 little girls are just something else. Isabella and Alexandria and baby Christine, got me through that whole thing when Dennis was sick, and her beautiful mommy, Adrian. And they're just gorgeous. They've just been such lights in my life.
Well, it's a great book, Christine Dwar-Hickey, Our London Lives by you, and it's published by Atlantic Books. I loved every moment of it.
Oh, thanks.
And thanks very much for being my guest.
That's
this
a
morning.
Tall, I'm delighted, Miriam. Thanks.
Yeah. Tell Dennis to listen back. He should.
You won't. I praised him too much at the launch. He's going around having a big head enough on him now for the weekend.
Thanks, Miriam. Okay. We'll take a break.
Okay, see you. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.